You have to pull inspiration from somewhere. And, you know, next thing you know, you've got this other thing that wouldn't have existed had you not sort of started from some point of inspiration.
Hello, Crowdies. Welcome back and thanks for listening. I have to admit, I'm jealous. I am very jealous of those of you who got to see concerts in New Zealand and specifically Crowded House concerts. The footage is amazing. The pictures are amazing. But my envy is strong. But I'm really happy that some of you are able to see our favorite band in concert. It sounds like the experiences were amazing. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in upcoming podcasts. So my best wishes to my friends and our friends in New Zealand and those of you who are able to see the shows. I hope to hear more about the great experiences that you've had. This episode is called Distant Sun, and it has some meaning, as you will pick out from the interview. It has a particular event tied to it. But, you know, when I think about Distant Sun, and I think about all those people, all of the people in the fan group here that are, you know, in various parts of the world, all coming together around our band, in support of our band, in support of the music. I can't help but think of, you know, the seven worlds colliding, whether it be virtually, and hopefully someday it'll be in person for the rest of us. But, you know, Distant Sun is not just a great song, but a great visual image that allows me to think about all my fellow fans out there and all of the love that we have for the music of Crowded House.
Crowded House, great band or the greatest band?
It's the soundtrack of my youth. Listening to Crowded House now just feels like a warm hug.
So my guest today is Jason Knox. Jason is a musician, composer, filmmaker, sound designer, video editor, and lives in Portland, Oregon. And Jason had a pretty special experience that I think you all will enjoy listening to and hearing about. So with that, let's take it away. Jason, good to see you. Good to hear from you. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
You bet. And happy St. Patrick's Day to you. This is, turns out we're talking on the festive day of St. Patrick's Day.
Yes. Yeah. I have a bit of Irish in me, so I'll go to McDonald's and get a mint shake or something.
Oh, man. Oh, that's a fantastic reference. You have aged as well.
Do they even make those anymore? That was a big thing back in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed. The Shamrock Shakes. That's a great idea. I might have to go out and get one of those tonight now that you've said it. I appreciate that. Yeah. Well, good. Well, so how are things? You're out in Portland.
Yes.
How are things in Portland?
Good. Yeah, we're starting to hit the spring out here. So it's weather's warming up and drying up a little bit, which is nice. I mean, I actually like the rain, but yeah, it's getting beautiful, even more beautiful. So that's getting great. Out in the woods with the dog and my wife for daily walks. So it's not a bad existence.
That's great to hear. So I'm just going to dive right into it because I think this is one of the coolest things that I've discovered. And I appreciate you reaching out to me to tell me about it. But you got an opportunity to work with Neil Finn and work on a pretty cool project that I think a lot of us have benefited from and enjoyed.
And you know, it's a project that I think is somewhat timely to talk about with Crowded House back on tour and concerts happening, which haven't really happened for a year. So I think it's a good time for us to talk about concerts. But you had a great opportunity to work with Neil Finn on the Seven Worlds Collide project. So tell me about that. Tell us all about that.
Yeah, well, like you, I mean, I'm a fan. So it's, to me, when I think about the experience, it's sort of, you know, stunning to me that it even happened, even though it happened to me in a way. So I'm still kind of interested in like just how the fact that Neil even was open enough to do that. And basically what it was I edited the Seven Worlds Collide concert video that took place in 2009. So I had reached out to him on Twitter because I saw a Twitter conversation that he was involved with a Q&A, and somebody asked if there would ever be a concert video of the 2009 concert that they put on. And he just replied to them and said that there was a lot of great footage, but he just didn't have the time to, or the resources to put it together into a proper film. And I just sent him a direct message because at that time, Neil was fairly active on Twitter, and he was also connecting with people, you know, following people who followed him so you could direct message him. And I just sent him a message saying, hey, if you're serious about wanting some help with that video, I'm a video editor and I could help put it together for you. And honestly, it's kind of a ridiculous shot in the dark, but I figured, you know, what's it going to hurt? And to my surprise, 2 hours later, he responded and asked if he could see some examples of my work. And so I sent him a link to a few things on Dropbox, and it moved slowly because obviously he's busy with other things, but eventually it got to the point where he put me in touch with the director, Simon Mark Brown, who directed the great documentary.
And Sun Came Out?
Yeah, The Sun Came Out. Yep. And it's a fantastic documentary. And he, as part of that documentary, they'd filmed a bunch of the concert footage, and they included some of that in the documentary, but it had never been pieced together into an actual concert film. So he got in touch with me and kind of warned me a little bit, just said, you know, this is going to be a mountain of footage, and it's, the sync is going to be all over the place, and it's three nights, and it's, you know, a messy project. I'm sure he was a little bit like, oh, does this guy know what he's getting into? And I kind of did, but I also didn't. I mean, I was just like, well, I'm just going to take a stab at this. And I feel comfortable with, you know, the basics of video editing and kind of solving problems and just sort of, you know, seeing what you need to do next. And that's kind of what this whole process was, you know, they sent me this stuff from New Zealand. Eventually he gathered up the files, sent them to me. So I had three or four hard drives of footage that arrived in Chicago. I was living in Chicago at the time. This is back in 2013. And then slowly over the course of the next 4 years or so, actually, I think it was about 6 years before it was released, just because of, you know, lots of projects on Neil's end that, you know, it wasn't a priority. I mean, he was excited about getting it out there, but it wasn't his, you know, focus, obviously. So he had other things that he had to deal with during those years. I just kind of would gradually whittle away at it and send him stuff, and he would send some thoughts, and then they also had to remix the audio. So that was Jordan Mark Stone. He sent back great audio mixes that I sort of swapped into place. And yeah, it was just sort of this crazy opportunity where, again, I was like stunned that he even responded at first, and was, you know, again, he's one of my musical heroes. So I was just kind of amazed that he got in touch with me. And then, you know, he would send me a couple Twitter messages over the course of the next months. And then once I got the footage and sent them a clip, he eventually emailed me directly and was talking in a little more detail. And then, yeah, he would email occasionally whenever he would see footage or there was something new to discuss in terms of how to make things move ahead. And yeah, it was kind of, yeah, it was a fantastic experience for me as a fan. I just kind of feel like the whole time I felt, you know, I was just kind of doing this as a way of saying thank you to him. And, you know, obviously there are other artists involved in that concert that I've always loved too. So it's kind of a nice way to just sort of do something for, you know, for them in a way, and also for other fans who might want to see it. So it was a great experience.
That's really amazing and really cool. I imagine when he said, you know, there's mountains of video. Do you know what you're getting yourself into? As a fan, you have got to, I mean, I would be beside myself. You know, mountains of footage sounds pretty exciting to me. What was your reaction to reading that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't know if I was so excited when I first read that. I knew it was, he was, you know, this is Simon who was spelling out the challenge a bit. And I just kind of, I took it in, you know, took him at his word that it was going to be challenging in its own ways. But I also was like, well, you just kind of can take one step at a time and figure out how to solve one problem and then like wait for the next problem to hit you. And when I got that footage, I had to figure out how to get these raw, you know, they just sent raw drives. So I had to buy a chassis to put them in and then get all the footage off of them. And I ended up getting a different sort of hard drive set up so that it could actually manage all the footage. And once I got all the footage sort of in place and started looking at it, yeah, that's when it started to be exciting, because then you're seeing sort of, you know, you're just kind of playing with these images of your musical heroes. And the first song that I put in place just as a test was Distant Sun. It was just, you know, the first song that was, that they opened the concert with. And once I did that, and just using the, you know, the audio that was included in the footage, it felt like, okay, this is going to work. And so I sent that to Neil and Simon, and then that's when Neil emailed back and said, hey, this looks great. And, you know, we're just keep on moving ahead with it. So yeah, it was just a test with Distant Sun. And then from that point on, it was just a matter of finding time to keep on whittling away during the weekends and evenings. And yeah, eventually sent him a rough cut, maybe a couple months later, of all the, basically every single song that was performed over those 3 nights, which was a lot of, you know, a lot of materials. Maybe the rough cut was, I think, close to 3 hours long or so. And I remember getting an email back from him that basically he just said, yeah, I'm just sitting in bed here on a rainy day and watching the rough cut, and he nailed it. And that, you know, that was a great feeling to read that email. And plus, it also just struck me like, oh yeah, this must be from Neil, because he's painting the picture and of the scene and this email the same way he does in his lyrics.
Yeah, very, very poetic, I'm sure. So as you're going through that footage, I imagine you're dealing with a number of camera angles and you know, trying to maybe mix and match different nights based on the performance. What were some of the challenges there that sort of cropped up?
Yeah, that was exactly, you know, one of the things that had to be sort of defined at the beginning. You know, you just have to develop some sort of rules for yourself. And the test for Distant Sun was pretty easy, because night three, in general, the third concert had sort of the most complete batch of footage. And so it was easy to take Distant Sun from night three and just kind of piece it together as one thing. But then as I started going through with the rough cut, I realized like there were other songs that were from different nights, and some songs that had fewer camera angles. Like some of the songs had maybe just a couple camera angles, two camera angles from one night, or from night three or night two. And so it became apparent pretty quickly, like, okay, you know what, this is going to have to be maybe more of a, sort of surreal patchwork of images that kind of represent these 3 nights together. So instead of like a, you know, a super polished kind of music video looking concert video, I just made the decision like, let's just let this be its sort of raw self. And I mean, it sort of lent it, so you kind of lean into what's there. It was shot by, you know, a documentary crew. They didn't have steady cams. They were in the positions that they could, you know, find, and they did a great job of shooting it, but it still had sort of like a rougher kind of look in terms of the footage, as opposed to like a, you know, something that has, you know, crane shots or drone footage or anything, you know, kind of fancy stuff you might see in a big outdoor stadium concert footage concert film these days. So I kind of leaned into that. And also it fit with the tone of the concert, which to me felt sort of a little rough and tumble. Like, you know, it's just these musical friends who were getting up on stage and kind of having a good time going through these songs that they had, you know, been, you know, playing with recording, number one, but then also, you know, covers of each other's works that they probably were learning those couple of weeks. And so it just had this, in general, a concert, from my impression of it, had this sense of just kind of community and friendship and just, you know, just a real sort of joyful sense to it without a bunch of presentational aspects to it. And so I felt, let's do that with the video. Let's sort of, you know, just let some of the rough edges show, and maybe even cut between nights where, you know, they actually changed the set on a couple, like one of the nights they moved the drum set from one position to the other, and clothes change from one night to another. So, you know, you could potentially get distracted by that kind of thing. But I feel like ultimately, once you understand that those are the rules, then hopefully eventually you just sort of start to focus on the spirit of the concert and enjoy the music and the performances. And, you know, there were things that I did early on to kind of set that up by showing, like, After a Distant Sun, which is all just one night, essentially showing Neil from a different night changing guitar while he's talking, while his voice is sort of overlapping it from a different concert. And just to kind of sort of present the rules to the audience a little bit, like, this is going to be somewhat surreal. And then again, trying to do that a bit in those early clips so that, oh, okay, it's understood that, you know, Katie Tunstall's hair is going to change potentially halfway through a song. So again, it was in general, just trying to present something that fans would enjoy and just kind of sort of be able to like hook into the spirit of those concerts.
Yeah. And some people might disappear on stage too. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, actually that only happened once. That was, I forget what the song was, but it was Johnny Marr's son came up on one of the nights and played acoustic guitar on one of the songs. And he disappeared partway through the song. And, you know, I think that was, in an ideal world, I would have loved to have been able to just not have that happen. But I also felt, well, I want to include his son in this because he was part of the experience. And, you know, I felt the same way about, you know, Liam and Elroy. Just to me, it was kind of exciting to sort of, oh, look, and this is before they were quite so involved with Crowded House, I believe, you know, in terms of touring and stuff. So it's sort of exciting to me to like, okay, let's help create this document for everybody who's involved and just sort of try to put as many people in the video as possible who are up on stage. I don't know if I got everybody, because I think there were a couple times when there were some background singers, some of the kids of the players or the producer who may not have gotten in, but, you know, just had to find the moments and do the best to, you know, you try to conceal it somewhat, but also at some point you just kind of, you have to let the audience kind of suspend their disbelief and just sort of run with it. And hopefully they don't get too distracted by that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's so exciting. I mean, it's just gotta be something just really fun and exciting to work on. And I think, you know, we're gonna talk about this in a second. You're a musician yourself, and I think, you know, I'm assuming you've put set lists together, and, you know, you've had, you know, you try to create a flow in the, you know, in the night, you know, in the concert, in the show, you want to put the songs in the right order and sort of create an emotion and a flow throughout the night. And I would assume that your background as a musician probably informed your inclination to keep the, you know, the sort of similar set list or similar flow, because that's, you know, that's what they wanted to create in that concert as well, or in that series of concerts. Is that, yeah, that fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't want to change the running order. I mean, obviously going between three nights, there were some, I think Neil decided to cut out maybe, oh, I don't know, three or four of the songs that were performed over the course of those three nights. But in general, I tried to essentially, you know, start with Distant Sun, because every concert opened with Distant Sun. And then it was fairly consistent in terms of the set list from night to night. So I kind of was able to follow that order. and then insert, you know, specific songs that might have been performed on one night or another in its relative place. And again, like just, you know, trying to keep some of the fun banter between it, because I feel like that's also, you know, that's, as you know, we Crowded House fans know, that's one of the great appeals of seeing the band live, is that connection that you get when Neil's talking to the stage, you know, Neil's talking to the crowd, or, you know, and it just, there had the fun that you sort of get and the kind of sense of connection. And there was a lot of that great warmth between the players and also between the audience. And so you just, to me, like that was important to capture and document. And yeah, in terms of the set list, just trying to keep it as true to the concert order as possible and make it just feel, again, essentially just like the documentary partner piece, you know, where it's just, okay, you've been watching the Sun Goes Down documentary that Simon directed, and now here's this other thing that you can watch that's also just more of a documentary of this concert, not a music video.
Yeah, no, just it's a fantastic product, and you know, a real gift to the fans. So just so folks know, it's, you know, it's Seven Worlds Collide, and you can find it on Amazon Prime. Any other spots, or is that the best place to find it?
Yeah, it's also on, I mean, it's available on iTunes, so I imagine Apple TV.
Okay.
I think it was also on Google Play, but yeah, I think, you know, the intention was to, I mean, you could rent it or buy it if you wanted to, I believe, but also I think the intention was always to make it very affordable or free, you know, if possible, on, you know, if you have Amazon Prime, just to, you know, I think Neil just basically wanted to get it out for the fans. So it was to make it as accessible as possible.
Well, I think we're all very appreciative that you reached out to Neil Finn, and you reached out to me to tell us about the project. And yeah, just like I said, just a real gift to us, the fans. So let's talk about your fan creds. So you are obviously a Neil Finn Crowded House fan. How did you become a fan of all things Crowded House?
Yeah, well, I'm a huge Neil Finn fan. I mean, he's up there among my probably top three musical heroes or, you know, inspirations. And I started listening to Split Enz in the mid 80s. Just this, you know, a friend of mine who I was playing in a band with at the time, he just loaned me his sister's Wyatta. I think that's how he called it. It was called in
Wyatta.
Yeah. That's how it was labeled here in the US. And I just immediately fell in love with One Step Ahead. And yeah, among others, I mean, One Step Ahead and History Never Repeats were the ones that jumped out at me, but the whole thing just kind of, it was a kind of pop music that I, you know, hadn't really heard before, you know, just growing up in the classic 80s sort of radio atmosphere. And so I just loved Split Enz, and I eventually got some more Split Enz. I was like a Split Enz greatest hits tape later in the 80s, maybe a year or two later. And then I stumbled upon an article in Rolling Stone when I was supposed to be doing some research at a library that about when they released that Temple of Low Men, and it was about, you know, Neil Finn. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, the guy in Crowded House is the same guy from Split Enz. And so I immediately went out and bought Temple of Low Men. That was my first, you know, album, and just lived with that for a year, just over and over and over. I just loved it. And of course went back to the original. I mean, I'd heard Don't Dream It's Over and Something So Strong, but they kind of came out on the radio at a time when I was just focused on getting into high school and distracted by other life stuff like that. But then I went back to the original release and was like, oh, this is all great stuff. But Temple of Low Men was the one that really sucked me in, because there was just, I mean, at the time, you know, a lot of pop music was very sort of sparkly synth based, and very, I don't know how to describe it, but just, you know, very, very mechanically synth based. It just kind of sounded very, there's this, you know, Roland D8, D50, I believe is the keyboard. And it has kind of like this very sparkly sound you hear on records of the day. And suddenly this record comes out that's very organic. You know, it has all these you know, a lot of guitars, obviously, but then the keyboards on it were these old Mellotrons and Wurlitzers and Chamberlains that I didn't even know what they were, but they just sounded like strings, like really interesting strings and flutes and these just beautiful sounds to me. And I was like, this is amazing. And nothing that I'd heard up to that point, you know, like it was kind of like, you know, obviously some of the sounds were reminiscent of 60s sounds like Beatles or stuff, but they were arranged and produced in such a way that it was just sort of just so beautiful and precise. And of course, in the mix by Bob Clearmountain was just, you know, I listened to it on headphones over and over and just get sucked into all the sonic details. And that to me is sort of was one of the defining characteristics of Crowded House over the years, is just there's all these levels of texture beyond the songwriting. I mean, the songwriting itself is just this fantastic foundation, but then you just soak in the recording and there's these beautiful details going on in either ear and just little subtle things that you can soak in on repeated listens. And so, yeah, once I was into Temple of Low Men, then I was in for good. And I, you know, Woodface came out and I was just addicted to it. So when the whole Nirvana craze was starting to hit like in 91, I was actually like just listening nonstop to Crowded House, you know, like mostly Woodface. And I was kind of going through my Crowded House and XTC phase at that point. So I've always been a little out of step from like what is actually quote unquote popular or hip at the time.
Yeah. But then we get smarter and we get older and we figure that out. And,
oh yeah,
you know, it's 20 years too late, but you know, as Crowded House fans, we of course realized just how cool they were early on. And
yeah.
Now everybody says how cool we are. Right.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I'm of course not disparaging Crowded House. I'm just saying like, they just weren't sort of in the, you know, in the popular culture, at least in the US, in the way that, you know, Nirvana and then all and Pearl Jam and all the sort of the quote unquote grunge bands of that time. You know, but I was just falling in love with Crowded House. And then of course, when Together Alone came out in 94, that is actually still, I think, probably my favorite Crowded House album. It was just mind blowing to me.
Yeah, I can understand that. And hard to disagree with that. Great album. So somewhere along the way, you got these video skills and audio skills. And I'm thinking maybe more, you know, from a career perspective, how did different jobs and opportunities you know, help you sort of build the skill set that you were able to bring to Seven Worlds Collide and you know, to your current work?
Well, I'd been working and recording, I mean, like, you know, just at home and for fun since I was in middle school, you know, playing in bands and just kind of doing the tape to tape kind of thing. And then I bought my first multi-track, 8-track recorder, yeah, when I was a senior in high school. Just saved up with some paper route money. And I think it was actually the same recorder that Neil used for a bunch of his demos. It was an old Tascam 388. It's a beautiful little machine that had a mixer and tape reel built in together. And so I just was always kind of messing around with that. And then I spent a little time working as an assistant in some studios in LA, and just eventually decided that LA just wasn't really for me. And also just, I was maybe 22 at the time and just kind of having some, you know, life crises just in terms of like, what do I want to do with my life? And is this, you know, is this career going to like be conducive to relationships or, you know, all these kinds of things. And so I ended up moving back to Wisconsin where I'm from and going back into school for computers and, you know, took a meandering path, but eventually found myself in a position where I was working at the music library at the university and doing recording locally for bands there and just, you know, just enjoying it. And I started getting into sampling because I loved basically those Mellotron sounds and Chamberlain sounds that were used, you know, by Mitchell Froom and then also by John Bryan. I loved some of his recordings too. And so I just started getting into sampling to get those sounds and then started expanding my collection of sounds and decided, oh, I need to find an outlet for this. So I signed up with some theater friends of mine at the theater department where I worked and did sound and music for Christmas Carol. And that went really well. And then I signed up for another play there, which was Metamorphoses, and that went even better. And I was just, you know, sort of discovering just the joy of composing with computers. And then that led to an opportunity to go to grad school for theater sound design at Purdue University. So I spent some years there and did a lot of, you know, a lot more exploration of using virtual instruments and composing, and sort of fell away from pop songwriting for a while. Although I was always kind of interested in how, you know, you could use these things and do a lot of pop songs virtually with virtual instruments, which wasn't quite, I don't think was being done quite as much at the time. And then, yeah, I did some freelance work. I moved to Chicago, did some freelance theater work for about a year and a half, and then got a job at a sort of an agency there. And I was there for about 10 years. And during the course of those 10 years, moved out to Portland. And now I'm doing freelance audio work and some video work. The video work was something I always did on the side. So I did music videos for friends, and just, you know, I always made movies as a kid. And so I just kind of, the video stuff was really just sort of self-taught. And as the software became available, I just started exploring it on my own and just happened to have enough stuff built up from some music videos for friends and a couple little corporate things that I'd done that I actually had something to send to Neil when he asked if I had anything that he could look at. And so, you know, those playful opportunities that I'd done before just turned into something I could use professionally for him. And then, yeah, it just kind of, you just kind of take one step after the other.
One step ahead, as one might say. Yeah. So, you know, as you're building your career skills in sound and audio and video, at the same time, you're still, you know, enjoying and exploring your musical side. And I think you've told me that you've been a musician pretty much your whole life, have been in bands, and are now involved in a few things. But we just listened to Tight to Your Ghost in the opening of this episode. But tell us a little bit about your band, Carousel Swan, and how that came together.
Sure. Yeah. So Carousel Swan is, I think of it more as a writing and recording project than a band per se, because it's really just, it's my friend Casey Vierock and I, and he's just a super talented guy. And we've been friends since 1991. Actually, we got into a band back then. And so he reached out to me in 2013, actually, the same year that I got into contact with Neil, and he just sent me a text one day and said, "Hey, we should do some acoustic recordings sometime." And I lived in Chicago at the time, and he was living in La Crosse, Wisconsin, our hometown at the time. And so it was sort of this thing where I would go back every, you know, once in a while on a weekend, and we'd record some of his ideas. So he's the main songwriter in that. And then I'm sort of the producer, essentially. And so what we would kind of whittle away at those things for on weekends here and there over the years. And he had another band that was sort of his main focus, which is Porcupine. And so this was kind of our chance to kind of explore, you know, just our, both of our love for kind of more acoustic pop potentially, or you know, kind of a lot of like sort of our love for new wave bands like Echo and the Bunnymen and Tears for Fears, XTC, Crowded House. I'm not sure if I would call Crowded House new wave, but we both had an affinity for sort of that early to mid 80s kind of quote unquote alternative pop. So yeah, so that's kind of what that project is. And it continues to a certain extent. I mean, it's been slower, obviously, because I've moved out to Portland. He was in Minneapolis for a while, and he's in La Crosse right now, just sort of weathering the pandemic a bit. Yeah, we still get together at least once a week and for writing sessions, and now he's got Logic as well. And so we sort of we send recording projects back and forth and try to make progress on stuff. You know, it's an interesting time.
No doubt for everybody. What instruments do you play? Well, first of all, the album's great. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
What instruments do you play on the album?
I play on that. I'm basically in charge of sort of all the colors around his guitars and vocals. So on that, I would take care of keyboards, some sort of additional guitars. I mean, he's a much better guitar player than I am, but there are times when I would just, you know, be adding layers of different electric or acoustic guitars, bass, and I would program some drums. We had a friend of ours play some live drums on a couple of the songs. And then we would just sort of layer some samples in with those. So I would take care of any sort of drum programming or other percussion. So, and then any background vocals, well, some background vocals, most of the background vocals on that album actually are him singing harmony with himself. I just did like a little 10cc kind of super thick layer on, I think, the last song on the album. But yeah, in general, it was my job to kind of fill in the colors. And, you know, we would kind of sort out the structure, like flesh out the structure of the songs, because he would typically come in with an A and a B section with, you know, really, you know, just great chord structure and then just a rough melody on top of it. And we would just kind of whittle away at that and figure out ways to expand it and maybe add a bridge here and what do we want it to do now? And, you know, just kind of piecing together the puzzle, chipping away at the stone, which are two different analogies, I guess, but that's the process. It's just, you just kind of take whatever approach seems right at the time.
Let's listen to one of the songs on the album. I think we're going to listen to Compass. And after we listen to Compass, we'll come back and talk about the song a little bit and maybe some connections to Crowded House. Thank you. I love that. That was great. Compass is great. What's any particular meaning, you know, the story behind the song? What can you tell me about the lyrics and the feel you were going for there?
Yeah, well, the feel is, the feel came originally from his original chord progression and just general melody for the verse. It just had this kind of, it just kind of felt like this kind of bounciness, but also kind of, it felt like waves in a way to us. And so we just kind of started going with this nautical theme, like in terms of a setting necessarily, but also that album took place when he was going through a divorce. And I had gone through a divorce a few years before that. So we were, it was just an opportunity for us to kind of, honestly, the writing of those lyrics for a few of these songs were just us hanging out, just talking about life and just being friends for each other. And that's kind of what a lot of our collaboration is these days, is we'll get together and just talk about what's going on. And, a lot of times the substance of those conversations will find their way into the lyrics. And so, yeah, I don't know if there's a specific meaning behind that song, but it's just sort of, a general sense of, a tone of some kind of, connecting, losing a relationship with being kind of lost at sea potentially. And, again, to connect it to Crowded House Neil Finn, I mean, there's, this style that he has of writing lyrics where it's a lot of imagery and it's not necessarily direct storytelling. And I feel like that's sort of, we do a bit of that in terms of some of the lyric writing that we work on, trying to like not necessarily be super literal with every line, maybe just paint a picture at times. Yeah. And so that's sort of like, I guess the meaning behind that song is just, trying to create an emotional texture and connect it to just that sense of loss that pretty much everybody can identify with.
Yeah. You use the term, color quite a bit, sort of color the song, and it's neat to think about songs in that way. I listened to a podcast recently, or a webinar about telling stories, and the presenter worked with other people who were trying to tell stories, trying to build up their storytelling skills. And so one of the questions he would ask them is, what color is your story? And initially, you might take a step back and say that doesn't make any sense. But when you think about it, these stories do have color to them. They have an atmosphere, an aesthetic to it that that you can pull out, maybe pull out in a simple form as a color. Is there a particular Crowded House song that you might identify with that might have really good color to it? Some techniques and maybe some things that we would see like in a song like Compass.
Yeah, well, I would, there's so many great Crowded House songs, but I guess, I think a good one to talk about might be Fingers of Love from Together Alone. Cause I mean, to me, that song really captures a lot of what I personally love about Crowded House. It has this kind of general, melancholy, kind of bittersweet feeling to it. It's, this way of combining sadness and beauty in both the lyrics and just kind of the emotion of the music that, I think it's one of the great things about how Neil writes. And, there's of course just these layers, these textures of sounds, and it's all very organic. So to me, that feels very kind of typical of what I love about a Crowded House song. And, you can get into more detail about like really analyzing the song. I mean, from a songwriter's perspective, I actually really enjoy doing that. Kind of like, what can I learn from this song? Like, what are like you get into like the time signature and what's the tempo specifically and the key of the song. Like this song, just as an example, this song is in G Dorian, which is sort of a unique mode. It's not just in C major or G minor or something like that. It's in this Dorian mode, which is I've got a piano here that I could demonstrate some things with you if you'd like to listen to a few things.
Go for it.
Yeah. So here's like a G Dorian scale. Well, let me say I'll just play a D like a G natural minor scale, which is this. So it has a very kind of like classic minor sound to it. And then with Dorian mode, what you do is you just raise one of the notes. You raise the sixth note in that scale, so it sounds like this. So it's this, that note being raised is sort of what gives it this kind of, it's almost like, I think of it sort of as the magical minor key. And that's what, you know, if you think about this song, Fingers of Love, there's to me, like there's a real magical-y quality to it, even though it sounds kind of minorish. You know, especially you think about like the ending as it's fading out in the outro, there's these kind of piano arpeggios that are just kind of like, you know, or it's actually, it's, you know, it's kind of these kind of, you know, and that's basically just kind of messing around in that scale or that mode. And yeah, it's kind of sets up, you know, sets up the general tone of that song. And if I could share one more observation about the song too, it's that I think is real classic of Neil Finn's writing, is that he will oftentimes wander outside of those, you know, that sort of general chord limitation, you know, like the chords you expect to be in that scalar mode, and he will throw in something sort of surprising. So like, you know, the basic chords for this, you know, are G minor to F in the beginning, and then it goes to G minor and then to D minor. And then the pre-chorus has this, the B major, B flat major to F to C, which, and all that stuff is well within the, you know, the G Dorian mode. And again, repeats that. And then he does something tricky where he throws in this E flat chord, you know, for the chorus. And that E flat chord is sort of somewhat outside of the G Dorian, you know, what you expect from a G Dorian song. And he'll sort of, you know, he'll kind of like blur those lines between major and minor and scales and the modes. And it's just, to me, it's those little surprising moments that kind of set his songwriting apart. I mean, there are many songwriters who do that kind of thing, but he's not afraid to sort of like find, again, the chiming of that perfect chord that's kind of, you know, like sort of like comes out. It's similar to like, you know, Don't Dream It's Over, where it's the verse chord, the verse progression is very classic kind of rock and roll, like, you know, 1-6, 4-5, you know, there's like, you know, how many times have you heard that? But what he does is he does the, and then down. And then he changes it up. You know, changes that one weird little chord going down that half step. It goes outside of the boundaries, the typical boundaries of what you would expect if you're just sitting down and writing a song. And to me, that's, you know, a great lesson as a songwriter, kind of diving in and listening to the way he puts his songs together.
Yeah, that's really cool. I bet folks didn't expect that they were going to get music theory in the podcast today.
And, sorry.
No, it's great. It's great. In fact, you know, one of my hopes for this was, as we've talked about before, you know, to be able to sort of go song by song and maybe do a deeper dive on particular songs. So someday when I win the lottery and we can pay for copyright, you know, and get some of the music on these, on the podcast, maybe we can start breaking it down a little bit, a little more distinctly. And something that you mentioned along the way, some of the guitar work in Compass, it has some connection to Fingers of Love as well. Maybe it's Mark Hart's guitar work and some of the a little bit of the style that you might hear in that. Want to say anything about that? Or
yeah, I mean, it was kind of Fingers of Love and also the opening track Carrie Carrie.
Right.
There's just this kind of like wonderful kind of I mean, Carrie Carrie is actually, in terms of mood, is very similar, I think, to Compass, just kind of this sort of sense of just waves and this kind of wandering guitar line. And that, yeah, that definitely inspired me when I was kind of just noodling around with the songs and just kind of coming up with some different guitar melodies to play over Casey's chords. And yeah, just there's, you know, there, we actually, you know, we obviously, we pull, when we're working on these songs, we're pulling from all kinds of things. Like we're talking about XTC or the Bee Gees or this or that. And just, you know, not that you're trying to like copy something directly, but you just, you can't help but be influenced by that stuff. And I think sometimes, you know, you do something and you get it wrong, or you get it, you know, kind of halfway to what, you know, what you were listening to before. And it's just its own thing. And the fact that you just, you have to pull inspiration from somewhere. And, you know, next thing you know, you've got this other thing that wouldn't have existed had you not sort of started from some point of inspiration.
Yeah. 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 It's, I don't know. Music is endless in its possibilities. And I think we've seen that, you know, obviously we see that in Crowded House music, but we see it just in all music in general. That's just that it's an endless, endless stream of possibilities. And, you know, I love talking to creative folks like you that are, you know, passionate as fans, but they're also, you know, very technically skilled in the music world and you know, just make great music. I mean, I think that's what connects, certainly this fan base is, you know, just a connection to great music that's a little bit different from I guess the mainstream norm. And you know, I think we're on to something good here. So Jason, thank you so much. Jason Knox, really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and with your fellow fans of Crowded House, and look forward to hopefully meeting in person and maybe even at a North American Crowded House show. Wouldn't that be awesome?
That'd be fantastic.
Thanks, Jason. Take care.
Thank you very much.
I'm
Thank you all for listening to this episode of Crowded In Here. In the opening, you heard Carousel Swan's Tight to Your Ghost. In the middle, you heard Compass. And after this, you'll hear 77 Summer from their album, The Wilderness Below. I hope you enjoy it. And sweet dreams, make waves, find peace.